What I've found so profound about selling books in Bitcoin is started selling books in December of 2023, Bitcoin's price in US dollars was at like high 30s, low 40s.
Yeah.
Since then, we have gone up 150%. And so all of those books that I was selling for like 24 bucks, it's as if I was selling them for $50 plus.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Block Reward Podcast. This time we've lost Scott. Don't know where he is right now. You know, maybe he's out in the woods hiking or something. But you've gained me and Seb. Who am I? Roger Huang, Senior Marketing Director at Block Rewards. This week's episode, I think we're going to do a little bit something special, a little bit different. I know we usually talk about Bitcoin, but this time we're going to talk about Bitcoin books because both Seb and I are both authors. And we're going to talk you through a little bit of the pain, the glory, and everything in between. Seb, how was the book experience?
I was writing a book.
First off, you guys just missed me trying to do the intro. It was garbage. You just did a way better job at introing it. So I think books are really interesting. I think I never expected to write a book. I don't know. Did you expect to write a book?
I hate to be like that person, but like, yeah, I've had like a pretty solid life plan of like writing a bunch of books.
That's just wild.
That's just me though. But I could totally see that. Like if you, I think your story's a lot cooler actually.
I think everyone's on their own path. And for me personally, like I dropped out of school when I was 14. I just wanted to be in the mountains. I wanted to kind of teach sports. Never in a million years did I ever think about writing a book. And so I think for me, academia wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
But going through teaching mountain biking, coaching, and really trying to distill down these complex biomechanical movements into their simplest form, I always enjoyed passing on information. And so when I left the mountain bike industry, I'd always had a passion for macroeconomics and finance. Mm. And so I just took that natural desire to want to teach. And I was like, you know what? I want to try and break down these complex ideas in finance and Bitcoin and try and speak to the layperson. And so for me, that's kind of how it evolved. I never, ever anticipated ever writing, let alone writing a book. And the actual act of writing a book only came about because I noticed that in my long form writing articles, there was a common thread in all of these articles. So I'm curious, like when it comes to your book, how did it kind of come about and where did the idea come from? Yeah.
Yeah, I had a little bit of like caveman logic with it. I was like, I was already writing so much about Bitcoin and then writing so much about China.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what if I just like combine the two topics together? But what I didn't realize, because I think in my mind, I was like, oh, these are two really popular topics. So they're going to add to each other. But instead, it's kind of more of a Venn diagram. People who are really interested are the people in between. Just like fewer really quality people. I'm biased because I'm one of them, but very few. But, you know, the writing really came together. Like, I think where I struggle a lot was like originally I really wanted to do like more of like an interview kind of that kind of like behind the scenes kind of book. I really wanted to interview kind of like the OGs, like the real story out there. But unfortunately, the OGs are OGs for a reason and very hard to get like anything out of any of them. And so it became a little bit more of a like philosophical book, like still sourcing people and the insights about what happened. But yeah, that was like the harder part for me. So I never struggled with like, I always wanted to like write books. That was kind of like a thing I've been thinking about for a while. My natural process is to try to understand the world through writing. And then I just always told myself, I just want to write a certain number of books. But
what is a certain number?
You know, not to be lame, but it's like become 21. I think that would be kind of crazy though. But if you calculate it out and you do one every 2 years, it's like kind of manageable.
Oh, you look at these like lifelong authors and you type in their name into Google and it just shows all of the books. Some people have 10, 20, 30 plus books. Blows me away.
Well, most people, there's some who are super prolific, like fiction writers, I think, especially. I think the thing that slows me down and what slowed me down, I'm curious to hear kind of like what slowed you down a little bit. Because I can kind of bang out like 5,000, 6,000 words of just pure spew. I don't know if it has like a ton of value, but like it's out there, right? But, you know, really getting into the research, like interviewing people, like really getting perspective, that slows you down. It's good. It's part of the craft, right? Of writing a book. You really have to get perspectives from all kinds of what you're doing. But it is, that takes a ton of time. Like I think like writing for me takes like maybe, like if I were just to sit in front of a computer and type things out and do like 5,000 words, maybe in a day or 2 days, right? Be kind of exhausted, but that's kind of like that kind of ballpark, right? But then, you know, it's really what gets into deepening the craft is like interviewing people, doing all that research, like reading other books and like getting citations and all this other
stuff. And it just adds such such greater like validity to what it is that you're writing about.
True.
And I think like very much, I found when I ended up writing The Hidden Cost of Money, it took me about 2 weeks to write 95% of it. And that was kind of the overarching narrative of the story. The remaining 5% was all of the evidence, all of the citations, and kind of that core thread that just tied everything together.
Yeah.
And that took almost a year to finish it.
Wow.
And I think it was just what helped me, and I'm curious, we'll get deeper into kind of the process of how our writing journey unfolded and how the books came to be. But I think what helped me is that I've always been a curious individual.
Yeah.
And so I've always taken notes on the books that which I read. And so I had 10 years of reading, which led up to writing the book. So when I actually started to write the book, I was just like, oh, wait, I'm mentioning this part. I remember taking some notes about this from this book. And so I could cite it so easily.
Right.
That helped. So I think there's something like 450 citations at the end of my book. Way too many citations.
You had a crazy number of citations. I think I had like 100 or 200. No, 200.
And if I did not have all of those notes from 10 years of reading beforehand and had to do all of that research to write the book, I think the book would have been a very different book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, like when you think about writing and the process of writing, what would you say is your process and kind of what have you learned through kind of your writing journey?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that, so I've worked with a lot of editors, right? Because I've done a lot of writing for kind of like media outlets and things like that, Forbes, what have you. And the one thing that really stuck to me and that helped me get writing to the degree that I do write is just like put as many words on paper as you can. That sounds like very generic, but it actually is in reality. You know, sometimes I talk to like runners or running coaches. I'm like, what's the secret? And they're just like, well, you just run every day. And similar to that, I find like writing, just putting it on paper, getting through it, and doing it one step at a time. That's become a really big hallmark for me for my writing process, is to really structure things out and then just write and never actually pause. Like never actually, like there's a time for, I need to look at this from a critical lens and refine things. And there's a time for putting everything I have on there, on the sheet. And I separate those times. And I don't think I could write if I were really like holding myself back in that way, right? Now, I've kind of developed this process now where it's like fairly standard, where I put out a draft. I kind of like frame sort of where I want to go. And I can't really even describe it, but I feel like sometimes I kind of know what the end of an article or part of a book might look like. And then I kind of write my way to it in a sense. At least that's for my writing style. A lot of the writing I'm used to is more like articles, like op-eds, right? So that kind of is one of the reasons why I think it leads in that direction. And yeah, that kind of a process for me has led to being able to put a lot of stuff out there and then being able to refine it kind of at a later stage. You're going to be driven totally nuts if you try to edit and write at the same time. You got to like separate out the two and really be clear about what you're doing at all times. I think of that like, not just like be clear with yourself about like what stage of writing you're in, but just be clear about like, what is it I'm doing right now? Like, why am I writing this? What is the goal of this? What is the purpose of this? And then just to write to it and then just put as many, you know, words on a page as you can.
It's, you know, I very much resonate with many of the points you made. And I think like the first one is, I remember listening to this talk. It was Tim Ferriss and I've completely blanked on the guy's name. And this guy has written countless books under his name. He's a prolific author. One of the things he says is when he first started writing, it was purely just from inspiration.
Yeah.
But the challenge is if you only write when you are inspired, you're barely ever going to write and you're not actually going to hone the skill of like crafting your skill.
Yeah.
And so he mentions that he makes sure like from 9 until like 3 p.m., Monday to Friday, it is about writing. And he can sit down at the desk and he can do one of two things. You can either sit there and do nothing, you cannot touch social media, or he can write. And eventually the act of sitting there and doing nothing becomes more painful than actually just trying to put pen to paper.
Right.
And so it's how he kind of breaks through that kind of writer's block. And he says, even if I end up writing 500 words one day, 2,000 words the next day, sometimes it's like out of that 500 words, I may even just have 50 words and like, I'm happy with these 50 words.
Yeah.
And so it's like just trying to get pen to paper because you start creating a whole bunch of content. And for me, I would say there's three main steps. If I was to break down writing, I kind of break it down in three main steps.
Yeah.
The first one is kind of that idea generation. Yeah. And I don't want to start putting pen to paper until I have a really defined idea about what it is that I'm actually writing about. And I also want to be passionate about it. And this is just me as an individual. I recognize that professional writers, many times it's their job. They get paid to write. So they want to just put down words. But for me as an individual, I have to be inspired by what I'm writing about. I have to feel passionate about what I'm writing about, because especially when you're writing a book and it's a process that takes months, if not years, if you're writing about something you're not interested in, I think you're
going to make it.
It's not going to make it. You're going to wither out. And so I think, first off, write about something you're passionate about and you have experience in. And then that kind of really helps with the idea generation phase. The second phase that I kind of tend to think about is just kind of like the planning and research. And there was a book that really stood out to me about 5 years ago, which was Stephen King's On Writing. And it's Stephen King's journey as to how he became a writer. And one of the things he talks about is how there's something called, and he, in his book, he frames it as like killing your darlings. And how when you go and write a chapter, it's very hard for you, if that chapter doesn't fit in, very hard for you to kill that chapter, because it's like this child, you've spent so much time crafting and building this child, growing this child, and then all of a sudden you have to cull it. Yeah. It's almost impossible. And so he's like, before I ever put pen to paper, I define my bookends of the book. Mm-hmm. And so what is the start? What is the finish? What is the rough narrative flow that I want to follow? And I found that helped immensely for me. And so I break it down by asking questions. Each chapter, what are the questions I'm trying to answer for the reader?
Mm.
And that to me helped solidify and create cohesion across all of my chapters. Mm. And then finally, once you've kind of built out the structure of how to approach writing, how to approach the book, what is the core narrative? How would I elevate or pitch my book? Then it goes into the writing process. And from there, like exactly to your point, if you're going and trying to write, get like kind of unload everything on your brain on the page, and then you're trying to edit it at the same time, it's so inefficient. And so it's just about trying to get a draft out, get that first draft out. And each, whether it takes you a couple of days to get a chapter done or whatever it is, try and complete sections before ever trying to look back over them.
Mm.
Because otherwise I find you can endlessly tinker on the minutia. And in the end, you may not even use that section of minutia. You know what I mean?
I got a little bit of follow up for you. Cause like, reading some of the Chi of Self-Sovereignty and everything like that, you're really, one of the things I really respect about your writing, it's very citation heavy.
Mm-hmm.
As we alluded to, you've got like 450 or however many citations in the hidden cost of money. How does that kind of like work for you? Like, do you put the citations like kind of like as you're going, or are you like, how do you do it? Because I can tell you that I actually put citations in kind of like a little bit. So I actually feel kind of guilty about this, but sometimes what I do is I know kind of what I'm going to write and the argument I'm going to write. And then I kind of find citations to just like back me up after.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of curious to hear like kind of your process with that.
It's a tough one. I would say it's partially that.
Yeah.
And then partially, sometimes I'll be reading something. And I find this is where I take a little bit more of a spiritual approach. And I've been blown away where I've started writing a chapter.
Hmm.
And I've been reading a book at the same time, completely, I thought, unconnected. And all of a sudden I've been like, this book actually answers this question, which I've actually been trying to answer, like write about in this chapter.
Yeah.
And so I've found the world has unfolded in such interesting ways that many times the citations have just supported themselves naturally as to what it is that I'm writing about. And I know that doesn't sound very, it doesn't answer many questions, or it's not like, I don't know how to approach that or how to use that technique. For me, what I very much, as I mentioned, has helped me immensely is taking notes.
Yeah.
And so in all of the content I read, all of the, whether it's documentaries, whether it is long form articles, whether it is books, if something inspires me, I take notes on it. And I think that the human brain has a phenomenal capacity to piece together unique points of view and create like new ideas. But what it's not very good at is storing specific points of information or data. And so when you start taking notes, what's really good is you can unload all of the specific points, the data, the facts, and then you can start thinking about how everything connects together. And that's what notes have done to me. It's almost like a scaffolding that stores all of this information of all of these books, all of this content I've consumed. Then I can step back and think about all of this content on a big picture and how everything pieces together. And so by the time I actually start writing and I'm talking about, I don't know, how money is impacting the parent-child bond, and I'm like, oh, I've got these 3-4 books that I've read, and there's these citations and studies they mentioned, and here's the links to the studies. And so I very much like supported this writing process. And so it's, to your point, I think it's a bit of a back and forth. There's sometimes where I believe this thing So I start writing about this thing, and then I go and find information to support it, confirmation bias. And then other times it's kind of like, this is absolutely fascinating. And I don't think people have pieced together these 2 points. So I'm going to support those 2 points of evidence. You know
what I mean? Right. Kind of like throwing that together. Yeah. And you also blend your personal experience too. Like there's a lot of your writing as well, which I also find can be difficult, but like it comes out really well.
Well, and I'm curious to kind of hear how you think about tone. Like when I write personally, I've found that given that I don't have a traditional academic background, I've always written in a very conversational tone. Mm-hmm. And I really like to try and appeal to just the average reader. And I'm curious, like when you write, are you trying to write in a specific tone? Do you think you have a Roger tone? Like what do you think about tone?
Yeah, I mean, well, so first I want to say that like that conversational tone and getting people to understand kind of, I think that's something that I aspire to, at least in terms of the writers that I really respect. So if I'm just throwing 2 random examples here, Orwell wrote Super Simply. And I think that's why his books have had a lot of enduring success. Mm-hmm. He also had a lot of really interesting life experiences. So put that all together. And there's a Chinese writer called Ba Jin, same thing, very simple writing. For me, my tone, I think that there's different versions of my tone. I think that there is one tone that I have, and it's actually when I write the quickest. And what I realize is kind of like a harnessing of my emotions. It's when I actually am angry about something. And this helps a lot because, for example, Forbes or other platforms offers me an immediate way to actually release that. Just funny story, I actually haven't really ever talked about this in any public setting, but I grew up in like a BBS kind of, which is like a bulletin board system. Mm-hmm. It's like a random basketball forum. I just don't want to get too much of the details, but I was like a kid that was like 13 or 12 and I was debating like 30 or 40 year old adults on like random, pretty random topics. Anyways, so that was kind of like my upbringing as like a writer. And then I also did like RPG stuff or like whatever, just in general. So I was kind of combining the two, but what really animates me, and to this day, I still feel very animated by it, is kind of like this like advocacy response. And so sometimes things, so I wrote an article about, for example, really recently, both Seb and I are in Canada and wrote about our new prime minister. Right. And that was kind of more of an immediate response to something he had written. And I was just like, wow, I can't believe that this is, you know, standing out. And so when that tends to happen, I tend to have this tone, and I tend to be more accessible, I think, and a little bit more. The pieces come out really quick. And I you can argue it's like a little bit more polemical, a little bit more debatey, and kind of in that kind of vein of like, you know, clear, crisp, but also I'm more emotional. In the book that I wrote, which is about Bitcoin in China, Would Mao Hold Bitcoin? got to get the shit out of it. You know, the tone ended up being a little bit more like academic-y and study. So when you don't find me in that kind of mood of like, you know, like, wow, this is a thing I have to respond to right away, which I think, by the way, is some of my best writing.
Would you say when you wrote in more of this academic tone, for Would Mao Hold Bitcoin, was that intentional? Or do you think that ended up kind of coming out in that way, given the citations and the topic you were discussing?
I think it was more, so they train you a lot when, I've never been like a staff writer. I've never been like a full-time journalist or anything like that, but I've written for a lot of different outlets, right? And one thing they try to train you, and especially an outlet like Forbes or other places, they try to train you to be like an analyst. Mm-hmm. Because the whole idea is like, you know, you are writing as like an expert on like a particular perspective. It's similar to academic, that academic kind of tone, except I've never actually also been an academic either. But I think it was partially the topic, but also partially, and I haven't quite found a way to navigate this myself either, but I would have liked to have inserted more of my personal story into the book, because actually the reason why I care about Bitcoin in China, there are a lot of very personal reasons. It affects a lot of things that go on in my life, actually. But because I felt like I had to kind of like be a little bit removed from that in order to tell the story, and then because I was interviewing other people, and the thing with writing about China too is like it's pretty tricky because everybody has their own perspectives and it can be a very emotional topic. And my book, just to be clear, does not pull any punches. It talks about Tiananmen Square. It talks about all these different events. It's definitely like triple banned in the mainland. So I never pulled punches, but I also tried to, I think, I don't know if I even deliberately tried this, but it ended up being the case that it was more like an analyst versus like, you know, if I actually talked about my personal story a little bit more, I think it would have been a lot more of that emotional kind of reactive tone. Some of the tone of which I think I'd actually do my best writing in.
Would you say, like, if you were to go back and write it again, would you want to add more of your personal story in that?
I think that there's been several articles, and it's really funny because I've been published on several outlets for technical kind of things. And there's been an article that actually sums up my personal situation and why I care so much about China and what's going on with all that. But I've never been able to publish that one. Like, there's no editor that's been willing to run that one. Mm-hmm. It's like this 5,000 word essay. And I think, yeah, it would have been nice. I always kind of told myself that, like, I would want to, you know, write that and get that out there. But yeah, I should probably just self-publish that and just like put a little bit more of myself into the writing.
What would you say is Cole's notes for this article? I want to know. It sounds fascinating.
It goes into like my family story. Yeah. And it's very similar to, like, you know, there's a lot of like Chinese diaspora who go through it. But the short of it is, like, you know, whenever you're dealing with a topic like China, you have like family and history, and in different countries, you know, every country has its own tragedies and its own kind of things. But China went through a lot in the 20th century, and that included, you know, and you wrote an article, I think, more in general on how many people Mao Zedong killed. I think it was 70 million that was cited, that plus or minus. I think it's on that degree of order. And but when you live in that setting, right, and I've talked about this in some settings, right, where I've brought it up in my Bitcoin story. Like, part of the reason why I got into Bitcoin was, just as an example, I was attending like Tiananmen Square rallies and stuff like that. People were like scared of China, even if they were outside of China. They were wearing masks and things like that. So it was a little bit like, now we have a lot of people who are like more privacy aware, but that was kind of like one of the kindlings that I've had. And I've spoken about that in public. But I think, you know, when you wrap into people's stories and family stories, you start to understand a little bit more like what animates them on an emotional level. Mm-hmm. So that's the essay I kind of wanted to write. It was very intimate, actually. It was really about my situation, my family. And we talk a lot about these big abstract kind of like China, US, and like whatever. But it's just like interesting consequences of different things.
It's on that note of kind of more the emotional touch, I've definitely found when I went through the writing process, my first draft, I think, was 60,000 words. And then I ended up going to first round of watching. I got one professional round of editing. And after that, the lady was just like, you know what? You need more personal stories. Like, bring in the personal stories.
Right.
People were like, even though they may not resonate with the exact story, people resonate with honesty and like that emotional connectedness. And so I wholeheartedly recommend, like, if you're writing a story, talking about these things that impact all of us, it's just like, bring it back to yourself. Like, what does it mean to you? And I find that that has a much deeper resonating connection as opposed to just talking about fact after fact after fact, citation after citation citation.
I think the way I tried to get around that is I told other people's stories. So my book had a lot of different anecdotes from other people, but I still feel like myself, I think this is just like, I totally resonate with what you're saying. I think I just have to figure out my level of how much, you know, and it's a very interesting context because there's a lot of like, don't say this or don't say that. So even me, even though I've grown up in Canada, there is still that feeling or that worry of not necessarily self-censorship, but there are motivations for why you would want to moderate certain things. I've never really I've gone to Bitcoin conferences and talked about the Hong Kong protests and talked about all things. I don't think I've ever really pulled a punch ever about criticizing different governments or things like that. I think there's a point where you don't want to necessarily get other people involved with that if they don't feel comfortable.
100%. Yeah. It blows me away when I step back and think about, like, I've grown up in Canada, the UK, in New Zealand, and these are Commonwealth countries, and we're in theory supposedly have had free speech. And so for me, just seeing people from different cultures, whether it's self-censor as a result of what they've seen, what their grandparents have seen, and so on, like it just blows me away, because I think that I've only until the pandemic have I started to question what I'm putting out there.
Right.
And there's almost a part of me that's been like, man, if I'm questioning, I actually want to put it out there more because I don't want to live in a world that where I feel like I have to self-censor because I'm scared of the repercussions of what I'm saying. You know?
Yeah. No, no, for sure. And like, I highly encourage everyone to get as much content as they can out there.
Hey everyone, quick question. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for our business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is hit record. They handle everything else, editing, writing, publishing, and making sure that it's perfectly optimized for every platform. They only work with disruptors, mavericks, and changemakers, people making a real difference, spreading big ideas. Typically, Podigy is fully booked, but right now they have a few spots open for new clients. Listeners of this show get 10% off launching their own podcast or optimizing their current one. Click the link in the bio for a free one-on-one podcast planning session with Podigy. If you are thinking about starting a podcast or you have one and you want to take it to the next level, I can't recommend Podigy enough. Check them out.
But yeah, maybe changing tack a little bit. How about, how's the publishing process?
I think that, you know what? One thing that I'd never really thought about too much, I've written two books. Beers for Bitcoin was the first one that came out, and I think it was April of 23. And then December of 23, I released It Didn't Cost Some Money. And going down the journey of writing a book, I'd never really thought about just kind of what is involved from a cost basis of actually bringing a book to market. And for me, it blew me away that one, you don't just have an editor. Like, there are so many different types of editing. And I would love to have gone through 7 rounds of editing. It's just so expensive.
It's too expensive.
It's so expensive. And so like most people, I wouldn't say recognize that like the first big round is like your developmental edit, which is looking at the overarching narrative. Do you have a cohesive narrative that flows that if someone was to kind of start to finish, they're able to kind of tell a story?
Yeah.
And then from the developmental narrative, and I may get some of these kind of mixed up a little bit, you then have things like a
copy edit, there's a copy line edit.
Yeah, there's a copy edit, which is then looking at a little more chapter paragraph structure.
Right.
And then you've got line edit going into sentence structure, tightening up all of those sentences, looking a little more grammar. Then you've got like proofreading, just making sure full stops, basic grammatic errors, you name it. And so out of those 4 edits, like an analogy I remember coming across a while back is it's like a statue. You start off with the chainsaw. You're just like freaking trying to get as much material away as possible to get the rough shape. And then you're getting in with maybe the smaller hacksaw to take away a little more. And then you're getting down to the scalpel and doing the tiny little intricacies of details. Mm-hmm. But if you start with the proof, like the proofread, and you're just trying to do grammar, you're just going to waste a whole bunch of time and end up cutting it all. And so being in a logical order is so important. And I'd never really thought about that. And I ended up at the time, I think it was around 65,000 words, I spent about $4,500 Canadian dollars to go and edit that. Like it was quite expensive.
Yeah.
So I was like, I can't afford 3 rounds of editing this. So in the end, I went and developmental edit and had like 2 or 3 friends go through and
kind of like readers, right?
Readers and read. And even now, I think even if you pay for professional editors, there's always going to be a spelling mistake or some grammatical error.
Yeah.
And so I have a list of about 20 different things that I need to go back, release V2 of the book and make those edits. And then after you've got like the editing, it then goes into like cover design, which I think a lot of people, they spend so much time on the book and they cheap out on the cover design.
Yeah.
And they just have a garbage cover design. And the reality is that people do judge a book by its cover.
Your cover is great, by the way.
And
we have one here, but like, if you want to like flag it out there, but yeah.
And I think that people do judge books by its cover.
Yeah.
And especially in the digital age where someone can't even flick through the book to the same extent,
right?
They're looking at a whole bunch of books on a screen. They want something that stands out to them, draws their eye in and engages.
Yeah.
So I think the cover design, never, ever, ever cheap out on cover design. And then for me, one thing I spend a lot of time on, my ex-girlfriend used to be a graphic designer.
Right.
She is a graphic designer. She actually did the cover. And she, I think when I was dating her years ago, she talked a lot about typography.
Uh-huh.
And so the actual page layout, being able to pick your font and the structure and the margins, makes it way more appealing and enjoyable to read. So I spent a ton of time and I ended up actually using, it was either Medium or Substack. I ended up using their serif font because it's a really clean, easy to read font. And then with a sans serif title font. And to me, I found that's much more easy to read. And I made sure academic papers tend to be on white paper. And I ended up going with Cream even though it tends to be more fictional books because it's way softer on the eye,
right,
more appealing to read. So really thinking about, I think a lot of people, we don't think about all of these tiny little intricacies.
The user experience.
The user experience of reading.
The reader experience.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And so I think that you've got like the editing, you've got the cover design, you've got kind of the actual page layout. And I think I even have one more that I've written down here, which was on, and they're like the audiobook recording. But even after you've gone through all of that, you then need to record. And I wish going back in hindsight, I'd recorded it. I could go back and record it now. I'm just partially retarded and can't read a sentence all the way through. And so I end up having someone else record it. But I think there's something, again, emotive about you reading your book. You're telling your story.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like when it comes to the actual process of kind of bringing your book to market, editing, cover design, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, we did a slightly different process because what you just described, Seb, was more like the self-publishing
route, yep.
Right? So the one book that I have, I do think my second book, which I'm working on, I'm considering different paths, and one path that's really compelling is self-publishing. I mean, you know, Bitcoin Magazine has actually been pretty good at supporting me through a lot of different things. But I do think there's a lot of compelling reasons to self-publish. But I published it and through Bitcoin Magazine, and a lot of the things. So I did actually end up actually paying for my own developmental editing. So I actually brought them a manuscript that was already developmentally edited. For me, the thing that was so important was to have a really honest look at what parts, kind of like what you mentioned, Kill Your Darlings. Like I just needed as many third-party readers as possible to tell me, like, is this too much or that too much? So give you a really tangible example. I wrote a book about Bitcoin in China. The first three chapters were literally going to be about like Chinese history in the 90s, which was a little bit insane. And that was the first thing my developmental editor pointed out, was like, your book is about Bitcoin, but your first mention of Bitcoin is like, like 80 pages in. So you might want to like reconsider that, right? So really dumb things when you think about it, but then it's kind of like taking yourself out of that process a little bit and then just trying to create. And then I think it's kind of a lot of the things follow through with kind of what you're describing, which is like, how do you make the reader experience better, right? And a lot of people, I think about it in terms of like, well, what are the words I use and things like that? But it goes way beyond that. It's exactly what you said. It's an end-to-end product. From the moment they see your cover to the moment they're finished flipping it, right? And the way that feels and even just the way that kind of whole experience comes together can be very important. Is very important. So Bitcoin Magazine did handle a lot of those things for me. So I didn't have to pay for them necessarily, but of course I had a lot of input into that. And so to me, like I echo what you said with the cover art. And one of the things I really wanted for my cover was I was like, this is something that has to appeal to people who may not be interested in either Bitcoin or China. Like that it could actually stand on its own. And I think we got there. I actually really like the way my book turned out. It's kind of like a coffee shop book. I think the cover is probably banned in the mainland because it's a mouse face pixelated. But that's a problem for future me to worry about. And, but no, like echo what you're saying. The publisher, and that's actually one of the reasons why I want to take a little bit more control over the whole experience. So Bitcoin Magazine kind of had its own standard, like this is what the paper is going to be. This is what the typography is going to be. This is kind of like the margins are going to be and stuff like that. So I didn't have as full of a control over that. But really, and also they gave me like a pretty tight timeline. So I wasn't able to get as many. I would have liked to, in hindsight, gotten more readers. That's what I really would have wanted to have. I did get three or four really good readers to go through it, but they only gave like really general feedback. They didn't really give like to the specifics. I would have wanted to have more readers and more chapter readers, slightly more interviews, all this other stuff. But we had a really tight timeline because it was not me was controlling the process, right? It was Bitcoin Magazine by the point where I handed off the manuscript. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, for people who are considering the publishing route, I think it's great. It was great for where I was because I did not have, you know, the reputation of having written. I mean, I'd written for Forbes, but I was kind of like more like an anon. I was kind of like behind the screen. I didn't really step out there physically. And Bitcoin Magazine, you know, obviously they run different events, different things like that. So they were really great at getting me platformed out to those events, getting the book out there. You know, the team has been really good in many ways. And I don't ever regret it. And I think that if you're a first-time author, you can definitely go like your route. I think self-publishing has a lot of really good things going for it. One of the downsides, like what you mentioned, is like you do take on a lot of cost. And so that, depending on your financial situation, could be a risk. But I think, you know, taking the publish route is also a good and valid thing, I think, especially if you're looking to a publisher that's actually in your space and is able to help you really get the word out. Because I would say that what might surprise people about the book, about a book period, is writing, similar to you, Seb, by the end, I had like 80,000 words in my raw manuscript. And I think it took me like maybe like a, like I would want to say like 8 months to get there, nine months. But the actual editing and everything, well, that actually took like a year and a half. So actually the editing was more than the writing, at least for me. And, you know, similarly, you think the publishing is what the publisher does, but unfortunately, most publishers don't actually help you that much in the marketing, but the marketing, we were actually talking about this before we recorded this. That's like, it's like 80% of the work. Like once you're publishing, it's like, yeah, you can have like a product out there and it can look great, but you know, if a tree falls, I forget how the metaphor is.
Tree falls.
Here, right? And there's just so, I think the one thing, this I'll always respect all writers who have gotten out there. And, you know, we were talking about how, like, you know, you're pumping things up on social media and stuff like that. And by the way, Seb's doing great, like 21 days of Bitcoin, everything like that. Like, we're trying to get that out there too. If he's not trying to sell, I will. But, like, but, you know, you do have to do all this stuff. And that's where I have a lot of solidarity with, like, anybody who's been through that part, like, they understand, like, how hard editing is if you really care about the experience. For your reader, you really care that the reader like actually gets their money's worth. And that was a big thing for me. The other thing about publishing is that you don't control the price. You don't actually set the price. And so for me, it was really big. Like I was racking my brain on like, I better give them their money. They actually came in and bought this and like had that vote of confidence in this. Like I tried really hard on my end. So like go the extra mile to do that extra interview, right? Get those like extra citations. I think I read like 6 or 7 books, just even as I was doing research on my own book, as I was writing my own book. So that was like a driving kind of motivator. But then after that, it's like once you even put that thought into the product, then it's like getting that out there. That is such a struggle. It's like an ever present thing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even now, you know, I don't really like actively do it anymore, but there's always like going around. You always have to like keep your story going. And, you know, one thing we were talking about, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this more expanded format and in front of our viewing public now, but it's that, you know, when you're pushing evergreen ideas, it's really hard to be part of a news cycle. But yet as a writer, you really have to work constantly hard, to just keep yourself in the conversation. Right. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on like how you navigated that. Cause that I've actually found that to be really hard.
No, I think that's a really good question. And I think, you know what, there's a couple points you made, and I'll answer those first, and then I'll go back to that question, which is, when it came to editing, I had a whole bunch of people in Bitcoin say, oh man, did you find a Bitcoin editor? And I'm just like, you know what? I didn't end up using a Bitcoin editor for one reason, confirmation bias. Like if they're reading Bitcoin content, they're going to be like, I agree with this. I agree with this. I agree with this. They're not actually strengthening your argument. And so there's a site called Readsy, R-E-E-D-S-Y. And Readsy is like, it's like a curated Craigslist of everyone relating to the publishing process. So whether it is editors, whether it is cover designers, whether it is typesetters, you name it. And they're able to kind of support you in whatever it is that you need. And all of these people have been like, they've worked for top 5 publishers, Random House, Penguin, you name it. And I ended up working with this very left-leaning socialist editor.
Yeah.
And at first I was just like, oh my God, this person, not a fan of them. And in the end, it helped my book immensely because she saw through all the holes in my argument that helped strengthen my argument. And so I think to anyone who's kind of out there listening to this, if you're a Bitcoiner looking for a Bitcoin editor, I'd urge you to actually maybe kind of drop that filter and just actually look for someone who is really good at their job. Look for someone who actually knows how to edit. And if they've got opposite opinions, I would even say that it may even support your argument even better because they're able to find holes in whatever it is that you're writing about. And so that's one thing that kind of stood out to me.
I'll just add confirmation bias. My developmental editor was a non-Bitcoiner. Shout out to Jason. Jason, if you're out there.
Listening to this Bitcoin podcast. Yeah, and I think like when it comes to kind of the publishing process, again, what's really fascinating is having someone who's gone down the traditional publishing route, and then I went down the self-publishing route. And I think what's interesting is publishing has changed so much in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Because we've gone from, if you want to write a book and you want to put it out there, well, if you went to any form of book printer, you would have had to order such large quantity that it made self-publishing almost impossible. And you also had to be pretty confident that you'd sell a large quantity of your books. Whereas what we've seen in the last like 15 years is print on demand. And so someone can go and order a book from Amazon, go and order a books from many of these online bookstores, and they'll print one book and send it to that user. So there isn't crates and crates of boxes of books sitting in warehouses waiting to be shipped out, which has made the writing process so much more accessible. Mm. And I think it's allowed self-publishing to sit on a similar playing field to traditional publishers and compete. Wow. And so we've just seen the explosion of self-publishing in the last kind of 15 years because of print on demand. And I think that the traditional benefit of going with a publisher was their distribution. They had all of these connections to all of these bookstores. Whereas now, when you've got Amazon, and Amazon, it's in the US, it's something like 40 or 50% of all consumption takes place on Amazon, which is just mind-blowing. 40% of anything purchased in the US takes place on Amazon.
That's crazy.
That's just mind-blowing. And it's the same thing with books. So many books are purchased on Amazon. So if you're on Amazon and you're on Barnes & Noble and a couple of the main sites, through print on demand as a self-publisher, you effectively have the same reach as any other traditional publisher, which is unbelievable. And so now the benefit of going with a traditional publisher, I would argue, coming from the self-publishing aspect, is slowly dwindling. Mm. And so I think that it makes sense if you are someone who has a profound story, you've got a huge reach, and that publisher can help elevate that, going with Penguin, Random House, awesome. But I think that if you're just an average individual like myself, a mountain bike instructor, who I want to try and put my story out there, and you're willing to sink a few thousand dollars into something, then I think self-publishing is a profound way to get out there. Going back to your question around kind of evergreen content, I wholeheartedly agree. I think the world we live in today, we were just talking about this before we jumped on, where there's a bunch of people in our industry that talk about news. And because they talk about news, they have something new to say on every podcast they're on.
You've got it easy, Lynn. You've got it easy. But anyways.
And you've got something new to say every time they jump on. And what's really challenging about talking about evergreen content, and for those that aren't familiar with the term evergreen, it's kind of like timeless content. Mm. I could write an article today that could be read in 20 years' time. It could have even been written 20 years ago, and it still remains relevant. And so I very much like to try and write evergreen content because it stands the test of time. Whereas if you're writing about what's happening in the news cycle right now, in a week's time, it's going to be out of date.
Yeah.
But what that means is when I'm going on these podcasts, I feel like I'm repeating myself. And and it's tough to be able to find and talk about new things all the time. And my narrative does slowly change over time as it evolves and I'm consuming more content. Mm. But it's a much slower change because I'm not talking about the news cycle. Mm. It doesn't really influence what it is that I'm talking about. And so I've definitely found that is a little more challenging. And like to me as well, I've definitely found that I sell books when I spend more time on social media.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't enjoy spending time on social media. I notice the negative effects on my mental health. Mm. And so I'm kind of in this conflicted state where I'm like, oh man, I really want to get people to get the book out there. Not necessarily financially, it does benefit me, but because I just want to be able to support people in their learning journey. But at the same time, I don't want to spend time on social media. So I'm always kind of conflicted in that. And so the marketing aspect is not my area of expertise,
right.
Which is why I'm not the marketing director of Block Rewards and you're the marketing director of Block Rewards. And so I'm curious, like, how did you, when you released your book, did you approach it? How did you approach it from a marketing perspective? Did you go in with a plan in place? I'm curious.
Well, so first I made a fundamental strategic error of creating a book that was my passion child, but not something that was like very easy to market. It's kind of one of those things. We were just talking about how some marketing is like you're selling ice to Eskimos, or you're selling, cheese to hungry mice. It's like very different type, right? I'm a little bit more on the Eskimo guy, if I'm using this metaphor correctly. But I did think about it like pretty systematically in the sense of like, one conclusion, maybe this makes the B-roll, maybe this doesn't. I was like, probably the thing that would help me the most marketing-wise for my book is I got arrested by China. Because like that would be just like ultimate irony. It's like, how many more times can China ban Bitcoin? Well, they did arrest the guy who wrote a book about Bitcoin in China. So I guess it's one more time. But no, leaving that aside, I mean, I was kind of thinking about it as like, where are these? So two things. Like one is I was thinking about the sections of my book and kind of like, what are the topics I can take out there. So what Seb was saying, completely correct. I think you can get a little bit more juice by like just thinking of like all the things you talk about. What are like different discrete kind of topics? And so three that have kind of landed, and I usually use this to like pitch different events or podcasts or things. One is just people love to get me to talk about central bank digital currencies because China, central bank digital currency. It's not super popular, by the way, I noticed, because I don't think people are, I think people are curious about it, but they're not like very positive. It doesn't like really positively get flowing. New monetary kind of world order stuff. And then another topic I kind of spanned from my book that I kind of framed was how China's bans made Bitcoin stronger. And to me, that was like a really good topic because it was surprising. It was contradictory, something you might not have expected. And then it was like a really simple kind of bite to the liver. And I've seen like these three variously get around. And so normally what I do is I'm just really systematic. And so I've gone to every event and literally pitched some version of these three talks. And I can tell you that every Bitcoin event in the world has either said no to me or has said yes to one of these three pitches. You know, those of you who have said no, you know who you are. But that's all good. Well, they don't normally say no. What they do is they just ignore you.
They just ignore you. Yeah. They just don't respond back to your email.
So I don't want to make it sound like as dramatic as that. But yeah, I mean, I think, and same thing for podcasts. It's kind of like, you know, you kind of go on these variants. But I think the second book I'm trying to, I was kind of talking with you a little bit, sneak preview. It's going to be a little bit broader. The whole idea is to try to get the average person on the street to understand like not just Bitcoin, but also just the need for freedom tech and encryption in general. So I think that's going to be a lot larger of a canvas to kind of play with. But that was kind of like the way I thought about it in terms of marketing. The thing that I was really difficult about my book is I realized my book sells really well physically. I think this is a combination of three things. One is thank you, parents, for dimples and nice smile. I think I do okay at a booth. Not necessarily physical appearance, just like, hey, what's up? The whole package, you know? Second, the book cover is really provocative. But like it comes off more provocative in a physical setting. And then third, it's just like you kind of just want to support like people, like, you know, it's just in-person connection, all this other stuff. It's kind of unfortunate because I can sell books in that way. It's just super tiring because you have to go to like events physically, you have to find new meetups and stuff like that. So I've actually organized meetups in like different cities I go to. And one thing, just living up to the more like grimy side of marketing that I do. Quick hack for all you aspiring authors, but I actually find everyone who mentions Bitcoin in their like LinkedIn profile. I don't know how successful this has been, if you have shown up or not, but like I invite them to the meetup I'm in. So I set a meetup in a city. I'm like, hey, I'm a Bitcoiner coming in. I usually try to partner with like the local Bit Devs or the Bitcoin meetup. But if that doesn't happen, I'm actually just literally hosting an event. I did this in London, a couple of other places, and it's not like crazy attendance, but I get like 30-40 people. You know, if they all come in and, you know, quite a few of them buy the book and it's kind of like been the book tour of sorts. But yeah, that's kind of what I've found is it's a little bit harder for me because I know what works. And it's like Bitcoin price and things like that. So sometimes I anchor my topics to that, but I can't do it that much, partially because I just don't feel like super inspired to do that.
I think as well, like Bitcoin, the community, there are certain values. And I think one of them being like integrity. And I think that it's really easy to kind of lean into the crypto sphere of just like,
yeah, I mean,
about the newest hit, the biggest trend, this and that, like money go up, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm not trying to maximize views. Totally. Right? Because if I was trying to maximize views, I'd be selling like Doge, Shiba Inu coin or something, like basically right away. How much time? I can't actually see. Sorry for taking a quick.
Yeah, I think we'll
wrap up. Okay, I had a fun question for you.
Yeah. Well, I think like quickly before, I'm curious. Bring it back to Bitcoin. One thing I've noticed, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, is that one of the disadvantages of being a small author is the fact that you don't really make up for it in volume. I'm not selling hundreds of thousands of books. And so you may not be able to go and support full-time income for the next 10 years on this one little book. And so bringing it back to Bitcoin, what I've found so profound about selling books in Bitcoin is started selling books in December of 2023, Bitcoin's price in US dollars was at like high 30s, low 40s.
Yeah.
Since then, we have gone up 150%. And so all of those books that I was selling for like $24, it's as if I was selling them for $50 plus. And so what you make up for in lack of volume, you're able to basically crush it in terms of your appreciation of the savings vehicle in which you're actually receiving. And so I think that as self-published authors, or even just as small-time authors, even if you went through a publishing house, I think that selling your books in Bitcoin and doing in-person events and receiving Bitcoin is a profound way to be able to make up for the volume side of things. I don't know what your thoughts
are. Yeah, I mean, I take payments in Lightning. I mean, that's probably the reason why I think the book does physically really well too.
Yep.
Because you're going directly and practice what you preach, right? Yep. And so I'm taking payments on Lightning and it's great. It's a great way to connect with different plebs. And they always love it because they're like, oh, like I don't take Venmo or credit. I'm like the weirdest vendor in the world. I only take cash or Lightning.
Privacy focused.
Yeah, there you are. So no, I found it's been such an awesome way. And I'm just always looking for ways to get paid in Bitcoin. Thus, you know, what we're doing here. We haven't overly pumped it, but you know, Blockboards, woo, Bitcoin payroll. But no, seriously, it has been a really big part of it and quite satisfying because I realize, you know, this is and you know, for some people, you know, it's kind of funny is they actually put the amount of sats that they paid. I noticed this with some people that have bought the book. They actually asked me to put what the, like, how many sats they spent.
It's like the block height and sats.
Yeah. So because I always offer to say, like, I always sign books with a block height.
Yeah.
But then some people ask me to put, like, the number of sats. And I'm like, well, I don't know if you're going to love that when you, like, look at it.
And,
like, this is like a $15,000 book, but we'll get there. I think we might need to wrap up soon, but just quick, fun question. I think you asked me a version of this actually before. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear your take on it. And I'll give a little spiel about it too a little bit later. But what you've been a lot of podcasts. I've been a lot of podcasts. That's some of the marketing that we're talking about, right? What is the one question you or set of questions you wish one of these podcasts would ask you that they never do?
Okay. You know what? I would say it's not necessarily a question. I'm going to pivot it. And it is that I noticed the difference between phenomenal podcasts and poor podcasts that don't really engage. And that it is when the podcast host is reading from a script of questions, and it's almost as if they ask you a question, you answer, then on to the next, then on to the next, then on to the next. And so if there's any podcast host listening to this, I've found being on the receiving end, the conversation flows so much more naturally. If yes, we have a couple topics that we want to kind of hit, but if we're able to just have a natural conversation, and even this conversation, like we've had a couple ideas of where we want to go, but when it flows, it's just such a more enjoyable conversation. Right. And I also find that it's these more broader questions that allow us to take the conversation where we want to go, as opposed to these more like confining, boxing in questions that are kind of like, well, that's not really what I want to talk about. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so if I was to reshape the question, it's not necessarily a specific question. It is more asking broad, open-ended questions and allowing the conversation to flow where it naturally wants to go, as opposed to trying to force it in a certain direction. Yeah. I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
And my thoughts are very simple. Just like, you know, if you could ask me a question about something other than Bitcoin and China, that would be, I get it. But I'm also,
Ethereum?
I love Ethereum. Ethereum's the best. No, I mean, like, I don't know. I'm a more complete individual.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so,
yeah, I think that like, it's been an awesome conversation. And I think maybe just like parting words, I don't know if you have anything to say or where can people find you?
Oh yeah, this is like back to the podcast. I mean, I think, for the purposes of this, like, let's just say, if you look up my name on Noster or Twitter or X, I feel like there's a bunch of fakes out there and I've not verified myself. So, at Rodridge1991 or Loki at Noster-verify.com and Woodmow Hold Bitcoin. If you take a look at that, that's kind of where you can find me. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can find me at Seb Bunny, and Bunny is Bunney. And there's a website, sebbunny.com, which is just kind of my blog.
We found out that, what is it, like 110 people look you up online like every month.
I don't know who these people are.
Just like add to that.
It's just me.
So it's 20. Well, I mean, there was like 20 Australia. I kind of assumed that was like your family or something. But like,
but yeah, you can find me just at Seb Bunny on Twitter, X. I have the website. And then, do work for Blockboard. So if you ever have any questions around kind of Bitcoin and payroll, feel free to reach out. And Roger has his book, Would Mao Hold Bitcoin? And I have The Hidden Cost of Money and Beers for Bitcoin. And we appreciate you guys listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.